This is a View from the Bridge, official podcast of the Belfast Giants for KingdomOfTheGiants.com. Today is Monday the 17th of August 2015 and my name is Davey McGimsey and we have got a little bonus offering coming your way today. Last Thursday, the Belfast Giants, in conjunction with the IIHA, had a very special evening with Brian Burke in W5. Burke is currently president of hockey operations with the Calgary Flames, but he's had a rich and storied career, teams like the Leafs, Vancouver Canucks, and he won the Cup in 07 with the Anaheim Ducks. Thanks to our good friends at Giants Live TV, David Lowry, and especially in this instance, Neil Whiteside, have very graciously given the audio up to serve the youths that weren't able to get along. What's coming up next is a great hour or so's entertainment. If you want to get involved, you can. You can get us on Twitter at AVFTB, podcast at kingdomofthegiants.com, the email www.soundcloud.com/AVFTB for all the full-length interviews, and there's Instagram and all sorts of other stuff going on out there if you have a wee search. Anyway, enough of my chittering. Here is an evening with Brian Burke.
Let's get started right now, and I would first, I'd like to welcome to speak the IIHA president, that's Aaron Gooley.
I don't know if I should stand for this. I suppose I will. I feel awkward sitting down. I just want to thank everyone for coming tonight. I think this is a very special occasion on several levels. The IHA is very happy to be working with the Heroes Program, which is the main reason why we're all here this evening. Certainly, the Heroes do great work working with kids, particularly from disadvantaged backgrounds. So we're very happy to support them in everything that they do. That is one particular reason why Brian is here this evening. He'll talk to you more about his passion for working with children. From the IIHA point of view, we're very happy with what we've been doing over the last couple years, particularly with working, our staff working with the Giants and Ice Hockey Northern Ireland in trying to bring everyone together for cross-border initiatives, because ice hockey isn't about borders. Ice hockey is about everyone working together. It's as Brian stated to the kids earlier. Excuse me, I have a bit of a chest thing. You know, when you play hockey, we're all part of one big team. We're all part of one big family. I think that really hit the nail on the head for me. So, we're very pleased at the way things have been going. Just trying to improve ice hockey on the whole entire island. You know, the Giants and the Junior Giants in particular do an amazing job with ice hockey here in Belfast in the north. We're big supporters of them in the Republic and everything that they do. And we certainly strive to reach the levels that the Giants have achieved in ice hockey. So really get to the man of the hour. So thank you again all for coming, and I look forward to meeting a lot of you after.
And then thank you very much, Aaron. And just before we get to the main event tonight, I'd like to welcome, for a few words, Norm from the Heroes Project.
Thank you, guys. I'm definitely not the man of the hour, but I'm definitely the guy who has not slept in hours. We've been here for like 5 days at the Ulster Folk Museum with 47 kids, and they're so wound up, it's like being with 96 kids. So we're with them at 5 o'clock in the morning until like 11 o'clock at night. We're on the ice twice a day at the Dundonald Ice Bowl, and it's been a pleasure. It's been a privilege. We've been able to work with these kids all week, and some of them have played hockey before, but the majority of them haven't even been on the ice before. The majority of them haven't even seen ice before. So you can imagine the parity that we don't have and the extremes that we do have. But the cool thing is the kids who have skated before are actually helping the young kids, which I think is, like, really great. There are five Canadians that came over from Vancouver and from Calgary. And Mr. Burke has been part of the Hero Program out of Vancouver, and the Calgary Flames are a presenting sponsor for a program that we just opened up in Forest Lawn that enabled us to bring in another 47 kids to a brand new program, and they committed for 3 years to making sure that we can change that community and provide more kids with more opportunities through ice hockey. In the program that we run here, our wonderful community partners that we could not live without, Rogine and Martina from CrossCare. Thank you very much, Roy. You're up there. They're from Dublin, and they provide boys and girls. And you can imagine, you kind of think that the hockey program is dominated by males, but our program has got a 50-50 split. And it's so cool because the girls are so much cleaner than the guys. I mean, the dressing rooms are a prime example of walking in. It's like, actually, I shouldn't say that because the guys have got Axe. You ever heard of Axe? You ever walk into a dressing room when the guys are spraying Axe? Like, you can't breathe by the time you get out. That's that men's perfume, whatever that is. So the guys don't even take showers. But we also have Louise Little from Beyond Walls. And Louise, thank you very much for helping out and organizing everything. When we first came here 9 years ago, we were speaking with Todd Kelman and the Belfast Giants. And they opened their arms wide open, relevant to developing some sort of a program for kids that couldn't otherwise afford to play the game. And not so much afford to play, but being able to partake in a game like ice hockey. The Irish Hockey Association and my buddy Mark Bowes, who I've known forever, they've opened their arms also. So I really kind of think it takes a big community to get these kids on the ice. And it doesn't matter what sport they play, as long as they play a sport, they're learning team building, their self-esteem is being built up, and that's what we do. We're not there to make them Belfast Giants or Calgary Flames. We're there to make them productive citizens in the community, help them sort of aspire to their dreams. So we believe in post-secondary, we believe in education, and if we can use the game of hockey as a catalyst to improve that, then all the more power to the kids. We've got 18 programs in 8 cities in Canada. We work with over 600 kids a year. I think we've probably worked in the area of the Republic of Ireland and the North here, probably about over 300 kids that's had a chance to actually hit the ice. We have a lot of kids that stayed with us during the whole series of years, and now they're coming back as young adults, and they're teaching where they once came from. So that's the cool part, is to see what a game can actually do to a character. So thank you very much for coming. Buy the raffle tickets, please. Put your hands in your pockets, not for the beer, but for the raffle tickets. We got great prizes here that we got from some NHL players. And thank you once again for all the support.
Thank you very much, Sharon and Norm from the Heroes Project. And one more, just before we get to our main event, I'd like to welcome Steve Thornton, Head of Hockey Operations for the standalone Belfast Giants, to say a few words.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll be very quick here. Most importantly, the air conditioning is on. If anybody's getting hot, you will cool down soon. But Norm touched on a couple things there about hockey being an enabler for great causes like this. The reality is it's Norm and the crew and Louise and those guys, how good you are with those kids and the time that you dedicate to this that really makes it happen. And we're so thankful that we're able to support it. It's been 8 years for us now that we've got some of the Giants going out helping. It's not about the Giants tonight. It really is about the dedication that you guys are putting in, being able to bring over Brian Burke, who, even though I was born in Edmonton, he's a Calgary guy now.
I'll speak slowly.
Yeah. and I'm a Boston U grad. He's a Providence grad who beat us in the Frozen Four that I was at. So I accepted this invitation with great hesitation, but I wouldn't have missed it. So a big thanks from the Belfast Giants to the Heroes, to the Irish Hockey Federation for putting this together. A lot of you have never seen this lecture theater before, so I hope you enjoy the evening.
Okay then, ladies and gentlemen, that brings our formalities to an end. You'll be glad to know we're onto the main event now, and I'd like you to put your hands together one more time, and a big Belfast welcome for Mr. Brian Burke. Welcome to Belfast. You're very welcome on behalf of myself, David, and the rest of the team. Of course, it's a great honour to have you here tonight, and got a lot of Calgary jerseys and T-shirts out there, the fans. So let's start with that first of all. And you know, president of hockey operations. We've heard of GM, head of hockey operations. What is the president of hockey operations?
Well, let me just step back for 1 second. First off, it's my honor to be here tonight. I'm flattered and grateful to be invited to speak. Hopefully I can answer some questions here and then answer your questions. For the Edmonton fans here, I will speak slowly. If I use any big words, if you're an Edmonton fan, raise your hand and we'll explain them. I won't do any complicated mathematical situations for you. I am grateful for the Flames gear in the crowd, so it's great to be here. Thank you. The president of hockey operations is a relatively new structure that you see in the NBA with about half a dozen teams, the NFL with a couple teams, Major League Baseball with about a half a dozen teams, hockey with about a half a dozen teams. And basically what this does is if you get a veteran general manager or veteran president of hockey operations, the pool of GMs that you can hire from is much wider, much deeper. Because you can hire a young guy, and he's not going to make those classic mistakes that really screw up a franchise. So I think you'll see every team in pro sports with a structure like this down the road.
Okay, that's right. You must be pretty pleased with the results from last season as well.
Well, last year we were picked to miss the playoffs. The NHL draft was just held, and there's a pretty exceptional player named Connor McDavid that went first overall to Edmonton. And it was predicted at the start of the season that we would compete in that derby to be the bottom team and have a chance to draft Connor McDavid. Well, we made the playoffs. Mind you, we made it in game 81 out of an 82-game season. But we played Vancouver in the first round, and we were picked to lose that playoff series, and we beat them, and then we lost to a very good Anaheim team. So it was an exciting year. The average NHL team breaks in 2 rookies. We broke in 6. So we're not just excited about what happened last year. We think we're going to build on that this year.
Yeah, I think a lot of the pundits really thought you may well struggle last year because you were in that rebuilding process.
Yeah.
And, of course, how much success do you equate to bringing in the GM? Of course, Brad that you have there now, he's never been a full-blown GM in the NHL. He'd had some experience in the AHL.
Well, there's 4 people that deserve the credit for our season last year, and I'm not one of them. Number one is our general manager. I brought in Brad Treliving. Have any of you ever watched the Dragon's Den show from Canada? His dad was a dragon on this. His dad's a very famous former RCMP officer who started Boston Pizza, which is a massive international chain. And Brad could have worked in the family business. He owns a couple of the restaurants. Instead, he launched his own career in working in hockey. He's the only guy I interviewed for the job. I really believed he was the right guy. And he made some moves that were critical to us. Adding Brandon Bolig and Derek Englund were critical moves for us in the playoffs. Our second guy that deserves credit is our coach, Bob Hartley, who was coach of the year in the NHL this year, the Jack Adams Trophy. Well-deserved. I thought he was going to lose that, the balloting, because we squeaked in. We got the 8th playoff spot out of 8 in the West. And Alain Vigneault was the coach of the Rangers, won the President's Trophy with the best record in hockey. I thought he was going to win. But I think our coach was the best coach in the league last year, considering what we had to accomplish. The third guy is our captain, Mark Giordano. We have a special captain. We're lucky in hockey that we have special players that play this game. People that care, and they work hard, and they're humble, and they're polite. And third or fourth would be Jay Feaster, who's the GM that I fired. Because I didn't feel we could take the next step with him, but he put a lot of key pieces in place, and you shouldn't lose you shouldn't lose credit for the things you do just because you're not there. I've seen how teams have blotted out my presence after they fired me, but we're not going to do that with Jay.
I'm sure you'd be very pleased to hear that. Let's go right back to the start. We'll come back to Calgary a bit later on, because I know a lot of the fans have been tweeting in questions for you on the upcoming season. But first, right back to the very start, of course, you went to Providence, as Steve mentioned, and you played for the Springfield Indians and the Maine Mariners in the AHL, and you went to Harvard, and then you started as a player agent. How did you make that transition?
Well, for the people here, I moved to Minnesota when I was 12, and this might encourage your kids that play hockey. I didn't start playing hockey till that next year, so I started as a 13-year-old. and in Canada or Minnesota, you're hopelessly behind at that point. There's only one way you're ever going to make it is if you outwork everybody and if you are a coachable player and don't repeat mistakes. So my sixth year of organized hockey, I was a walk-on freshman at Providence. I ended up being the captain, full scholarship the last 2 years. The Flyers claimed my rights back in 1975. And then after our season ended, we lost in the playoffs. Clarkson spanked us. We got killed on a Tuesday night. And the Flyers, their farm team was in Springfield, Massachusetts at that point. And they asked me to go to Springfield and play 7 games, which I did. I didn't play much, and I didn't play well. The one game that they came to watch me play, the first line right wing got kicked out of the game on the first shift. He got in a fight, and he pulled the guy's hair and got tossed. So I had to play. And I remember they had a defenseman, a great big guy, about 6'6", and everyone said, don't touch him, don't look at him, don't make funny faces at him, don't say a word, he'll kill you. And I got him. He was coming around the net with a puck, and I hit him harder than I ever hit anyone in my life. So after the game, it was the only game I played well, the Flyers decided to sign me. I signed a 2-year contract and played that next year in Maine, in Portland, Maine. We won the Calder Cup, which is the American League Championship. I played a very small part in that. I wasn't very good at that level, and I went back to school. I got my law degree at Harvard. I'm still licensed to practice law in Massachusetts, which is scary because I haven't practiced law since 1987, but I can still go back. Ooh, that's bad.
Then you made the move into the player agent territory.
Yeah, I practiced law for 6 years. I ended up representing players, not by design. The first 3 clients I had were guys that I'd played with in the American League. So Frank Bathe, Mike Busniak, guys that you wouldn't remember. But then Pete Peters was our goalie in Maine, won the Vezina Trophy in 83, and he asked me to represent him. And then I had Brett Hull, I had Kevin Dineen, I had a whole bunch of guys when I went back on the management side in 87 as the assistant GM in Vancouver. I had a pretty good stable. I had great success in the agent business, but it was never planned that way. I didn't go to law school thinking, oh, I'll represent players.
From then, of course, in Vancouver, you said assistant GM. You moved on to what is now the Carolina Hurricanes. They were then the Hartford Whalers when they relocated in 1997.
Are you blaming me for that?
No, not at all. Not at all. I've got all the info. You've done a great job, it says here.
I was the GM in Hartford for one season, and the owner and I didn't get along.
You had helped them build the team, though, which made to the 1994 Stanley Cup final. You didn't get along with the owner. I was going to ask you what happened and why did you not stick around to see that call come to fruition?
Because I didn't get along with the owner.
That's fair enough.
And I've got to remember the golden rule in pro sports, the people with gold rule. So,
fair enough. So then eventually you ended up as executive VP and director of hockey operations at the NHL itself.
Yeah.
What did that entail?
I did suspensions mostly. Like, I was the guy now that my son actually works for player safety now in the NHL office in New York. And I did suspensions. I negotiated collective bargaining contracts with the players and the officials. I worked on international hockey, which I love. I have a long resume in international hockey. But basically, I was the guy that suspended. You read, a guy gets a 5-game suspension, that's what I would do. I'd suspend him for 5 games. So I was the top cop in the NHL.
And then, of course, you went back to the GM side of things with Vancouver again in 1998.
Moved back to Vancouver in 1998 as GM and president, and I was there for 6 years. And the team got sold, and I got canned. And it's a recurring theme as you go through.
Yeah, it is. It's quite a few. We'll come to later on your relationship with the media. There's quite a bit online about that. But then, of course, you went on to work on a stack of TV hockey coverage with various networks, which gave us those great mashups on YouTube.
Well, we had a lockout in 2004-2005 season. We lost the whole season. So when they didn't renew my contract, so they didn't get fired in Vancouver. They just didn't renew my contract. It felt the same. Economically, it had the same impact. But I spent that next year I worked the World Cup of Hockey for the CBC doing in the studio. And then I did studio commentary on the labor dispute as a lawyer and a former player and former executive. So I kept busy, but basically out of work as a GM for a year. I mean, I knew when I got fired, I wasn't going to work for a year. No one was going to work for a year. So, but thanks for bringing that up.
No problem. I can't win. Then said, so you're taking the GM role in Anaheim as well. What have I got here? Yes, before taking the GM role in Anaheim and winning the Stanley Cup in your second year, beating Ottawa 4-1 in the series. Must have been on a personal highlight, despite everything you'd achieved, climbing through the ranks up to that point.
Well, what happened in Anaheim was I'd never been out of work before, and it's very humbling when you are. And I'd always said I didn't want to work in Southern California. You know, like I just, the travel's really tough, and there's no seasons there. You know, like, I think people would be crazy. It's sunny every day, and some of you are looking at me like, what's the matter with this guy?
Yeah, here you see, we'd love it to be sunny every day.
But I couldn't stand it. There's no, the leaves don't turn, there's no geese flying, there's no seasons. Like Christmas, people are wearing sweaters at Christmas time. You know, your teeth should hurt when at Christmas time when it's so cold. So I had great owners there. We were really fortunate that Brian Murray, who'd been there before I was there, had left a couple special players. I see a Getzlaf sweater up there. He had just drafted Corey Perry and Ryan Getzlaf. I brought Teemu Selänne back. I signed Scott Niedermayer as an unrestricted free agent. And the first year we went to the conference finals, which was critical. That playoff experience is the only reason we were able to win the next year. And then the next year we won the Stanley Cup. But I always say we were fortunate enough to win the Stanley Cup because there's a great deal of skill involved. But there's a lot of luck involved in winning a championship, staying healthy. And I remember the night before we played, like we knew, and this will sound arrogant, but I'm not an arrogant guy. This is just we were confident in our team. We knew our Stanley Cup was the conference finals. We were playing Detroit. We were confident we could beat. The other conference final was Buffalo and Ottawa. We were confident we could beat either one of those teams. We had to beat Detroit. That was our Stanley Cup. We had a meeting and talked about it. Like, guys, this is the series that we have to win. We can win the next one. We have to win this one. And, you know, we're in Detroit. We won that series 4-2. So game five was in Detroit. We're down 1-0. It's late in the game. Scott Niedermayer takes a shot. Nick Lidstrom put his stick down on the ice. It hit his stick and kind of waffled over Dominic Hasek, who was overplaying the puck, as he always does. And it goes in. Now we're in overtime. In overtime, Teemu Selänne makes a great strip. Guy circling the net, Thomas Lilja. Teemu strips him of the puck, and Andy McDonald stripped him of the puck, and Teemu scores. And then we win game six. So they hit four posts that game. So we went 2-1 in overtime, I think it was, or 3-2 in overtime. They hit four posts in that game. One of them goes in, we don't get to overtime. So there is some luck involved in it. But, like, I remember the night before, so we're up 3-1 against Ottawa. It's the night before game five in Anaheim. And we're going to close it out the next day. We know that. So I'm tossing and turning. My wife says, what's the matter with you? I said, what do you think is the matter with you? We got a game tomorrow. And she said, these guys will not let you down. This team will not go back to Ottawa. They're going to do this tomorrow night. You're going to get a ring tomorrow night. And I said, I believe that. I really believe that. But there's that whole Twilight Zone thing. You know, what if Scott Niedermayer comes up with the flu in the morning? Or what if a guy gets hurt in the warm-up? These things happen. First shift, Chris Pronger separates his shoulder behind the net. Now, they shot him up, and he finished the game. But first shift, he's got a second-degree separation, and he hobbles off with his arm hanging down. I'm going, oh, no, here we go. So it does take some luck. It's a special feeling, obviously, when you're able to do it.
Was there a lot of shock among the fans when shortly after the next season you decided to step down?
Well, I actually worked the whole next season. We lost to Dallas in the first round. And I didn't step down. I was let go in Anaheim.
Before they're being kind, you online, they said you stepped down. Same effect.
Well, but I'll tell you what happened was I had signed a 4-year deal when I went to Anaheim. And this is important because the owners deserve an honest explanation of this. They're wonderful people. But I'd done a four-year deal, right, when I went there. Won them a cup in the second year, conference finals in the first year. My kids were back in Boston. That whole time I worked in Vancouver and Anaheim, I commuted back 2 weekends every month at my expense. So for 11 years, I went from the West Coast back to Boston to spend weekends with my kids every other weekend. And I said to them, the travel's killing me. I can't continue to work here. I don't want to leave. I'm not asking to get out of my contract. I will do my 4 years, and then I'm going to move on. And if I hadn't won you a championship, I don't think I'd be entitled to ask for it, but I did. And so now I'm going to do what's right for my family. They said, would you then step upstairs? So that's how the whole transition moved. I didn't quit. I didn't ask to be let go. They wanted to have someone in the GM chair that was going to be there for a long time. And I went duck hunting for a couple days.
Okay, then, and I think we're going to take a quick intermission and break here just before we get on to the Maple Leafs, because we want to sell some more raffle tickets.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, there we go. Gold talks. Give you a chance to nip to the loo as well. So we'll take a quick 5-10 minute break, and we'll resume with things very shortly with Brian. Of course, your illustrious career that would be so far covered. Let's go some of the other things that you look after and work on outside of off-ice at the minute. I was looking up some of your incredible charitable work you've been doing as well. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, basically, we'll step back for a second. When I became a rookie GM, it was 1992, and I was a GM at Hartford, and I thought, okay, am I going to just do this like everybody else does this, or am I going to paint a blank canvas the way I want it painted? And I decided I'm going to do it with three pillars. So I've worked for teams that lost money, worked for teams that made a lot of money, but I run my teams like a business always. So if you're a season ticket holder and I make a mistake, $3 million in the minors, guess whose money I just wasted? Yours. So a lot of teams don't run it like a business. My teams, we run it like a business. That's number one. Number two, my teams play an entertaining style. You can play boring hockey. My teams are never boring. It's one adjective you'll never hear in a sentence with me. My teams are not boring. We play an exciting game. We try to hit in all three zones. My teams fight. We try to score goals. We try to trade chances. I'll see a coach interviewed after a game, and they'll say, how do you think the game went? And he said, it was great. We only gave them 2 scoring chances in the second and third period. And I'm like, those people paid a lot of money for those tickets. They saw 2 scoring chances? It's like watching 2 guys paint a barn. So my teams, we deliberately play an entertaining style. We charge a lot for tickets. We're not going to win every night. I want you to walk out of the building saying, this was a fun team to watch. Third is, we're going to give back. My teams will be known. The trademark of my teams will be that we're going to give back to the community. So that's where it starts. I was raised that way. My primary things are I do a lot of work with the LGBTQ community. I had a son who was gay. I lost him in a car accident a few years ago. We do a lot of work in his memory. I do a lot of work for environmental causes. I'm a spokesperson for Ducks Unlimited Canada. I do work with Special Olympics, which I just love. That's probably the most fun I have. I do work with the Canadian military and first responders. I've been overseas to visit Canadian soldiers in the field 5 times. I signed up all 5 times to go to Afghanistan. Went to Afghanistan 3 times. The other 2 times we got grounded in Kuwait. And I'm missing one. Canadian Safe Schools Network, which is their LGBTQ component. So it's really important to me. The beauty of working in Canada is that hockey, it's probably, there's not a sport like it in North America. Like, I remember someone's cell phone rang. See, if you're a GM meeting, your cell phone rings, you get fined $100. should we find the lucky, unlucky bastard at $100?
Yeah, it goes into the charity pile.
Yeah, buy some tickets, whoever it is. So to me, it's the profile, it's probably comparable to, I don't know, Premier League football in London, where everyone follows some team and everyone knows who the players are. It's not like that in the U.S. Like in Anaheim, I remember I used to shop in the same grocery store with Scott Niedermeyer. Now here's a Hall of Famer, one of the greatest defensemen that ever played the game, 4 Stanley Cups, and he could shop in complete anonymity in this grocery store. The only 2 guys that got bugged in Anaheim were Chris Pronger, because he's 6'11 or whatever he is, 6'6. And he's got a big space in his teeth, so he's distinctive. And Teemu Selanne, who everyone loves Teemu. They were the only 2 players that people recognized. In Toronto, the 23rd guy on the roster, everybody knows. So I remember I was watching a Red Sox game years ago with Theo Epstein, who was the GM of the Red Sox at the time. And Theo said to me, "Are you me in Toronto?" I said, "Theo, I'm Teddy you in Toronto." I mean, my favorite story about getting recognized in Toronto doesn't even include me. My second year there, Dave Nonis was my assistant GM. He took over for me after I got fired. He became the GM. So Dave Nonis is the assistant GM. He's not the GM, he's the assistant GM. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. It's January. We were terrible. It's minus 25 or 30. And he's walking down Front Street at 1 in the morning going back to his hotel. It's deserted. There's nobody on the street, not a soul. As he's walking along, he hears someone yell, "Nonis! Nonis!" He looks, there's nobody. And he sees there's a guy sleeping on the steam grate above the subway. It's a homeless person. And he goes, "Nonis, what are you going to fix my Leafs?" A homeless person. I was taking my kids to a Blue Jays game. I saw someone had a Blue Jays cap on here, a T-shirt. There you go. I was taking my kids to a Blue Jays game, and there's a guy begging on the street. As I walked by, he says, "Huh, going to see a real team, huh?" And I said, "I draw the line at being taunted by a beggar. I stop. Today I'm drawing that line. You have no right to taunt."
Your mic's starting to go, apparently, so I'm going to use that one.
Okay. So the profile it gives you, when I was in Anaheim, I was GM of the Anaheim Ducks. It was a great job, but no one knew who I was and no one cared. In Toronto, in Calgary, you're a recognizable person with an audience. And if you don't use that to do some good, to affect some change, then I think you're wasting the opportunity.
Yeah, you campaign for a lot of inclusiveness within hockey in Canada as well. Of course, it's something that's brought you to this side of the water this time with the Irish Ice Hockey Association, because they're trying to, you know, promote the sport within Ireland, because you've got 1.5 rinks among 6 million people here. And, you know, obviously the model in Belfast has been very successful. What do you think we need to do to maybe take it to the next step south of the border?
It's real simple. We've got to build an arena, then we've got to build another one, then another one. Like, you look at where hockey is in the U.S., in non-traditional hockey markets, wherever they've built an arena, youth hockey springs up. And I said this example earlier in the day. When I was playing hockey growing up, there was no hockey in Texas. Nobody played hockey in Texas. Last year, there were 30 kids on Division I college scholarships from the state of Texas. So this is what happens when you build rinks. People start playing the game. It's the hardest game in the world to play. It really is. And you can argue all you want. You'll never win the argument with me. Well, you think about it. Every other sport, you got cleats on, you got basketball shoes on, you're on a floor, we all know how to run, right? Pretty simple, that part. Not in hockey. You got to do all that on a piece of steel that's about 1/8 of an inch wide. Most sports, you hold the object of the game. It's a ball. You throw it, you catch it. Hockey, oh no, we're going to take it 1 degree away. You're going to have a hockey stick. And we're going to make it full contact just to make it interesting. So it's the hardest sport to play, and you know, it's just a marvelous thing to. It starts with ice. We need ice. It's that simple. We need more ice in Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. And back to your role as GM. Okay, you look at stats obviously every day when you're deciding on what players to bring in and that. But what other qualities might you look at when you're looking at someone and think, am I going to place them in the team this year?
Well, we have. Not to get too technical and bore everyone to sleep here, but if you look at the way we put teams together, the way I put teams together, imagine a Stanley Cup upside down. So there's four boxes. Those are your 12 forwards. You've got four lines of three players each. Then three pairs of defensemen, and then two goalies. So it looks like a Stanley Cup turned upside down. We have a job description for each box. So the first line, one of those guys you want with some size. You want high skill. That's your first power play unit. One of those guys you want some size. And then you hopefully want breakaway speed. Second line center, be second power play, first penalty kill. Third line center is a defensive role guy. We want size there. We want some hostility and belligerence there. He's got to be good on faceoffs. He's your first penalty kill. And so on. So each box has a description. And for you to win a championship, you need to fill each box. So what do we look for? Depends on the box. We might get to the third round of the draft and say, okay, Joe Smith only has 4 goals for Owen Sound.
but he's plus 27. He plays against the other team's first line, and he's got 87 penalty minutes. He's our kind of guy. Like, we need a guy like that. So it depends on the box. Now, what's fashionable right now in pro sports is analytics. All these guys think you can sit behind a computer and find athletes. I think it's a joke. We use analytics, but it's the third tool we reach for in the toolbox. So some of our kids aren't used to fixing things, so I say to them, okay, try to explain this to them. You go to a house, there's a leaky faucet. What tool do you grab? Anybody? A wrench, right? You're not going to fix it with a flashlight or a tape measure or a pair of pliers or a screw. You're going to grab a wrench. Our players have never fixed anything, so they don't know. But the first tool you reach for us, is eyeballs. We want to go watch the player play. We have scouts that have expertise in this area. Our first line of evaluation is, let's go watch them play. And not just what happens on the ice. We watch everything in the game. We watch the warm-up. Is the player intense? Is he prepared? Is he committed? We watch the game. The coach comes down and yells at him. Does he pout? Does he slump? If a teammate makes a mistake, does he bark at him or does he help him? Is he respectful to the officials? So it's not just the play that we watch. Then the second thing, the second tool for us is evaluation of the player's character. I don't care how good you are. You can't play for me if I don't think you've got character. So we interview as high school teachers. We interview as billets. Most of the players in junior hockey move away from home and live with a family. It's called a billet family. We talk to his billets. We talk to his Bantam coach. We talk to teammates of his. We try and get a sense of, is this a guy who we can win with? And then the third thing is analytics. We believe in analytics, but we believe it's the third tool you use. This all started with Moneyball. Anyone here read Moneyball? Okay, if you want to read a great book, read Moneyball. This is about Billy Beane, who's the GM of the Oakland A's, and he had to find a way to compete with the big money team, so he came up with a statistical analysis. It's a movie, too. It's worth a read. Now, what I like about Moneyball is, you go to the Louvre, and you stand. You go see the Mona Lisa, and everyone stands in front of it and looks at it. These guys stood over on the side and looked at it and said, what's a different way to approach it? I love that. I love the originality of it. But it works in baseball. Baseball is a series of repetitive events. There's no contact. There's very little random in the game. Our game is random and chaotic. The analysis doesn't apply as well. I think statistics and analytics are perfect for baseball. Not sure how good they are for hockey.
Okay, then some of the guys in the audience tonight and elsewhere have sent in some Twitter questions for you using the hashtag AskBurke, other than the one person who put hashtag AskBurkey.
That's what everyone calls. If you call me Brian, I don't turn around. So in hockey, everyone goes by nickname.
We'll do a couple of these now. Stephen Thompson asks, who's the best player that you've managed?
You know, I get asked that a lot, and I've been really lucky. I've had some great players, so I think I'd have to say a couple names. I was fortunate enough to have Mark Messier play for me in Vancouver, and that was special. Marcus Naslund was special in Vancouver. Scott Niedermeyer and Chris Pronger, both Hall of Famers. So I've been very fortunate that I've had some great players. So I'd say that would be the group, and I'm sure I've left someone out even there. Tamu Solani's in that group. He was a special player, special kid too.
And Philip Armstrong is looking to the future. Who currently in the Flames organization are you most excited to see develop and head into the future?
Well, the most we're excited about right now probably is Dougie Hamilton. Our GM pulled off a trade with the Bruins to trade for Doug Hamilton from the Bruins. And he's a 6'5", 228-pound right-shot defenseman. And I mention right-shot because right-shot defensemen, I have no idea why. They're hard to find. There's, for every good right-shot defenseman, there's three good left-shot defensemen. Don't ask me why. We actually did a study on this when I was the assistant GM in Vancouver, trying to figure out if it's because of dominant top hand. And what we could conclude, as near as we can tell, it's whatever stick he picks up when he's a kid, and he shoots that way. He's a right-shot defenseman. He's 6'5", 228. Very high intellect, very good student. He's a 96 student, I think. Parents are both Canadian Olympians. I think he's the guy that everyone's most excited about.
And one more for now then from Will. Would you rather your players give up beer or Twitter?
I mean, I have a Twitter account. I'll make this confession. I don't do it. They're my tweets.
but my oldest daughter does it for me because alcohol and Twitter do not mix. And I have been known to get in feuds with the media. And
we'll come to that later on.
Yeah, so I have a Twitter account. I don't follow anyone else. I know you're supposed to follow other people who have a Twitter account, but I don't. So I don't care. The players are going to – we're stuck with social media. You know, it's my question is, what's going to be the next Twitter? There's going to be something worse than Twitter. Be something even more invasive and intrusive to the point where players have absolutely no privacy or privacy, as you say it over here, I think. My question is, okay, rule number one is alcohol and Twitter do not mix. Our players haven't all figured that out yet. Rule number two is, what's the next harmful, intrusive thing that's going to be worse than Twitter? I don't think anyone should give up beer.
I think that's probably a satisfactory enough answer. Yeah, we've got that, yeah. let's go back now to what we were discussing earlier on and head to Toronto this time, of course, with the Maple Leafs. You've been fairly vocal throughout your career in the media. And as you mentioned, you've had quite a few feuds. And you got a fair share of criticism for a trade with Boston for Phil Kessel. What happened with that deal?
Well, I felt in Toronto, I felt we were approaching price point fatigue with our tickets. We weren't a very good team. We had the highest ticket price in the league, and we weren't a very good team. And we didn't have any stars. I felt we needed to put a star in the lineup. And so I paid a very heavy price for Phil. Ended up being the second pick overall, which we never calculated. We talked about it because as a GM, you have to talk about it. We thought we'd pick eighth or ninth. Turned out to be the second pick and turned into a really good player in Tyler Seguin. But Phil Kessel scored 35 goals or 30 goals for the average around 30 for the Leafs on a so-so team with a right-shot center. Never had a natural center. I'd do that trade again in a heartbeat. And, yeah, we got a lot of criticism. My relationship with the media is I get along famously with most people in the media. I think there's a handful of real lowlifes, and I don't get along with them. And they don't like the fact that I criticize them publicly or take them on in front of the – I'll go on the radio and say this guy's an idiot. Well, they don't like that. They don't mind calling me an idiot, but they don't like being called an idiot. So my theory has always been I looked at my contract very carefully. I'm a pretty good lawyer. Nowhere in there does it say that I have to take shit from the media.
Fair enough. I watched one of your press conferences you'd given. It was just after you'd taken up your senior advisor role with Toronto, and it lasted over about 20 minutes. You know, it was a long press conference. Is that something that's natural in the NHL for if that job change was to happen? Because obviously here, if this happens in the Premier League, a manager moves on, you don't see that manager coming out, talking to the media himself. It's a press officer comes out.
So you're talking about when I went to Calgary or when I left Toronto?
When you left Toronto.
Yeah. Well, what happened was I was telling these guys this story before I came here, that I had no idea I was getting fired. Like, I'd been told by ownership that if I missed the playoffs that year, it'd be hard for them to bring me back. So I think it's a natural assumption you're going to get the season, right? It was a short season. So that day, I was driving to the airport, and I've busted both of my hands, fights, football, high school football, motorcycle accident, and they hurt when the weather changes. My hands hurt. And they hurt that night, but there was no weather change. And I thought, it's a premonition, right? There's something bad going to happen. But I was driving to the airport, and they called and said, you need to come downtown. I said, I'm on my way to the airport. And they said, you need to come downtown. So I was a half hour away from the rink, from the ACC. So I had a half hour to think about why I was getting dragged downtown. So I'm doing the checklist you do when you're a GM. Player got in a fight with a girlfriend. Player got something at the border. Player got in a fight in a bar. like there's all these things your players do that cause you all kinds of headaches. And I was like, well, someone would have woken me up for any or all of those. So I'm two blocks away from the arena, and I thought, they're firing the basketball GM. That's why they want us all there. So I walk into my office. I have no idea I'm getting canned. And I walk in, and there's three people in the office, and they won't make – they're all looking for loose change on the floor, right? They're all – and I'm like, oh, no. I'm getting it. That was the first inkling I had, which means it was really unfair or I'm really stupid. It means one of those two things. So they wanted me to, I mean, the media came to my house. They were parked outside my house. And I knew this was going to happen. I went and took my daughters, who were at that time they were 6 and 8. I took them out of school and told them. So I waited at my house till it started to break, and then I went and pulled them out of school and said, your dad just got fired. And they were like, do we have to move? I'm like, no, you don't have to move. Don't worry. It'll all be fine. And then I started driving north. I was going to go up to my hunting lodge and kill a couple days. And they have a great tradition in hockey. When you get fired, they come to your house and they have a wake. All the people you work with show up at your house, and you have a wake. And so you just got canned, but all your friends show up with arms full of beer and wine, and you have a wake, and you pay a horrible price the next day. Well, I had the wake in Vancouver. I didn't want to have a wake in Toronto. So I started driving up to my hunting club, and I called the guy. I said, could you send the boat over? Because this hunting club's on an island. And he said, Berkey said, the seas are running too high. We can't pick you up. So I went back to the condo, and, of course, Randy Carlisle, Dave Nolan, they all showed up. We had the wake, even though I didn't want to. And I met with the media 2 days later. And, yeah, I felt I owed them that much. And the overall, like, of the 100 people that cover a team or work in our industry in the media, 95 of them, 96 of them, 97 of them are quality people. They're honest people. They want to get it right. But it's a handful that don't care that wreck it for everybody. So even at my press conference, there's a guy there, Steve Simmons, who I can't stand. And he asked me a question. He said, well, now that you got fired, how does this affect your role with the U.S. Olympic team? And I said, well, why don't you ask them, Steve? I said, you know what the best part about today is? I never have to speak to you again.
Fair enough point. The media maybe give you a bit of a hard time there because you were friendly with the head coach, Ron Williams, and you'd given him a contract extension, even though the results, they weren't going the way you would all have hoped. And I think your quote was after the last home game, it would be cruel and unusual punishment to let Ron coach another game in there. What happened with that?
Well, Ron Wilson and I played 4 years of college hockey together. He was the star on the team. I was the hardworking other captain. You know, every team when there's in college, one captain's a really good player and the other guy's just a guy that works hard and listens. And I mean, I won the academic award, but so... We go. His daughter's my goddaughter, but I didn't hire Ron Wilson in Toronto. He was there when I got there, and I don't feel you should ever fire a coach until you've given him the assets where he has a chance to win. And I didn't feel we were just getting there with Ronnie, but then we played a home game and 18,000 people were chanting "Fire Wilson," and I'm not making anyone go through that again. So I fired him that Friday night in Montreal. We played in Montreal the next night and. I brought Randy Carlisle in. That's what changed it. But I think our business is way... I think GMs constantly throw coaches under the bus. They don't give them the assets they need to win. Team doesn't do well. It's just simpler to push this guy out of the door of the airplane than jump yourself and admit it was your fault. So I've never fired a coach I hired. I've only fired coaches I inherited, including Ronnie.
Speaking of successful, of course, you had massive success as a GM for the U.S. national team at the Winter Olympics in 2010. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, we won a silver medal. That still bugs me. I mean, I will tell you this. You play for the gold medal, and if you don't win, it sucks. Like, you got to sit there on your bench and watch them get their medal. And they give you flowers, you know, like flowers. It's a friggin' hockey game. And these girls give you flowers. I'm like, I want a gold medal. I wanted to play them again. Like, Phil Kessel hit the crossbar in overtime. If you go back, we scored a late goal to force overtime with the Canadian team. And then they scored, Sidney Crosby scored a great goal. It's just one-game knockout. We're not used to that. You know, like, we play best of seven. And I wanted to play them again. I wanted to say, you bastards will play again tomorrow. And I bet you that knowing the Canadian team, I bet you they would have played us again. They would have. Even with a gold medal in their pocket, they would have said, we'll do this again. The Finns won the bronze medal, and they're out there dancing and waving. And we got to sit there and watch these guys get their gold medal. It sucked. It is. And, you know, I say this obviously kidding, but. This is right after the Canadian referee kicked the puck to Jerome McGinley, who then passed it to But I've gotten over it. I'm not bitter about that at all.
That's going to end up on Twitter tomorrow. You are aware of that.
No, but Billy McCreary was the referee, and Billy McCreary is too honest to do anything. So I joke with my Canadian friends that we lost to a great team on a great play. Like, I don't think there's any other player on the planet that could have scored that goal. Because Ryan Miller was our goaltender, and he hadn't poke-checked. He's not a poke-checking goalie. He hadn't poke-checked in the whole tournament. And Sid had kind of a bad angle, and Ryan changed his grip just a little bit. No one in the building saw it. I didn't notice it until I watched the replay. He changed his grip a little bit. Now he's going to poke, because here comes Sid from here, and Sid rifled it right then, as soon as he saw him, because now there's a little space. Great goal. So, yeah, it was. I was proud of our team. We were picked to finish sixth in that tournament, and we ended up losing in overtime in the gold medal game. I was proud of our team.
Yeah, let's talk about a couple of players now that you've maybe associated with both clubs. But first of all, last season in Belfast, of course, we had Kevin Westgarth.
Great
here
kid, yeah.
On the team. In fact, you've been quoted as saying, I think it was on his documentary in Hockey Night in Canada, you thought he could be a future GM in
the
NHL.
Yes, I do. Yeah, I do. He's a Princeton graduate, brilliant kid. Did his wife come over with him?
Yeah.
Okay, you guys get a look at her. She's tall. She's tall. She's gorgeous. I told him, I said, you got to have a lot of kids. I'm going to draft any boys that you have, I will draft on the spot. His wife is a lacrosse player, a basketball player, yeah. I mean, she's wonderful. But I said to him, you got to have kids. And he was excellent for us. He good leadership skills. He's tough as nails. He was great for us. Great kid.
Yeah, maybe we didn't see the best of him in Belfast last year. But, of course, someone we did definitely seen the best of years ago and also played in Calgary was Theo Fleury.
Well, I never had Theo, but I know Theo. He's still around. He lives in Calgary. Obviously had a great career, had some hard luck in his career, overcame a lot of things. His life is good right now, which is important. But, yeah, I think people here got to look at Theo. He's an excitable guy.
Yeah.
He's No, his problem is no one told him he was small.
Understatement of the night. I was actually reading a story online. When he played for Calgary, there was an instance where he was sent off the ice with a bloody jersey and a fan threw his replica over the glass so he didn't have to miss a shift. You know, real fan favorite there.
Yeah, he was. And that, the good thing is a fan replica sweater would have fit him, too.
Who's your kind of fan favorite on the team now?
Well, I think that the guy that we all love, the coaches and all the management people love, is Chris Russell. Now, Chris Russell's dad was a bullfighter. And you would know, that's what they call them now. They used to call them rodeo clowns. So the bullfighters, they don't have clowns in the arena except for the bulls, right? Once the rider gets thrown, now that rider's life is at risk. So the bullfighters is what they call them, in the barrels and with the funny clothes and everything. It's kind of a high-risk occupation. It's okay, so here's your job. Your job is make sure he doesn't get hurt by this 2-ton bull who's really pissed off and has big horns. So Chris grew up in a rodeo family. Like, you don't have to teach kids who grew up in a rodeo family anything about hard work or fearlessness. They already know. And he set an NHL record for blocked shots. He had 15 shots blocked against Boston this year in one game. He's not a big guy. He's like Theo, that no one ever told Rusty that he was little, but he's kind of, everyone on the team kind of loves him, all his teammates and all the management people, because we respect him so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, something we're very excited about here in Belfast that is going to help spread the message of ice hockey. It's coming later on this year. I know Shane Johnson's here, is of course the NCAA, the Friendship Four coming to town. Give us a kind of an insight, maybe some people who don't know about this, what we can expect.
Well, the NCAA, the quality of hockey is excellent, and I think people really enjoy it. It'll be interesting to see, because you have the Olympic-sized sheet here, right?
Yeah.
In this building. Be interesting to see. There's only a couple teams in college hockey that play on the international ice surface. So that's the number one thing I want to see, is how they adapt. So Boston College plays on, like, your rink is 15 feet wider than ours. So the length is the same. Our rink is 85 feet wide. Your rink is 100 feet wide, roughly. It's metric, but roughly. So what's happened in Europe, they're starting to shrink their rinks. Like in Finland, in Helsinki, where the two teams play, Jokerit and HFK, I guess it is,
They've shrunk the rink to 90 feet. So it's 5 feet wider than ours. It's a hybrid ice surface. But on the Olympic sheet, there's no hit, not enough hitting. The puck gets out of trouble, and you don't see it again for a week. We want sustained flurries, and we want a lot more hitting. So I think our league, over time, we're going to have to move to a bigger sheet. But I'll be curious, number one, to see who can adapt to it. New Hampshire, University of New Hampshire plays on a big rink. Boston College plays on a big rink. Boston University, 3 miles away, plays on a hybrid rink. They play on a 90-foot rink. And then the University of Minnesota plays on an Olympic rink, but they're going to a hybrid rink. They're actually renovating their arena to go smaller because it's more exciting hockey. I think people like it. The quality of hockey is good. The kids work really hard at that age group. I think people here will love it. Full face masks, which some people might not be used to, but these kids play hard.
Yeah, it's going to be great as well in the community. You know, 12,000 tickets, I think it is going out to kids at schools here to maybe come in for the first time to see a Belfast Giants game or experience ice hockey. That can only be a good thing for the sport in general.
Yeah, you can't. The one thing that's driving me nuts is everyone keeps calling ice hockey here.
Sorry. Hockey.
There's only hockey, right? There's another sport called field hockey, but there's only hockey. When we talk about hockey, there's only hockey. And I know over here it's different.
Yeah, we have to differentiate because there's a club in
Bangor.
You don't
have to while I'm here.
Yeah, that's fine. There's a club in Bangor that would argue with you, but you know.
I know there is.
Just before we take some questions from the floor tonight, because I know there's a lot of people who'd like to ask you something, I'd like to ask Steve right now, if you've got the mic over there. Growing up, of course, watching maybe some of Brian's teams, is there any, you know, memories or questions you'd like to share?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was born in Edmonton. I moved to Ottawa when I was 7 years old, so I remember Ryan's team in Anaheim beating Ottawa again in that year. I think I look forward more to the press conferences after sometimes than the actual game, but it was you knew that the team that Brian put together would be the hard-working team, the physical team, and I think that he did hit the nail on the head that his teams are always exciting to watch. You know, I was able to watch a lot of the Toronto games when they used to come to Ottawa as well, so I think that the excitement that the fans would get out of that, Calgary's lucky to have them.
Okay, then that's great. Let's see who's got some questions. We'd like to take a few now just before we get on to the raffle tonight. We've got a mic, I think, that someone can take out. Who wants to go first? Don't shout all at once. There we go. Okay, just up there with the blue.
You shout it out. We don't need a mic. Go ahead.
Blue shirt.
Well, I think we went to the draft with a ton of picks, right? We had 3 seconds and 2/3, and our first. So we had more top 60 picks, I think, than any other team. And they were looking at rebuilding. They traded Lucic for a pick. I think they were looking to stockpile some draft picks. They ended up picking like 11, 12, 13, almost 3 in a row. And we felt at the time they were trying to get 3 in a row and try and trade up to get Jack Eichel at 2. So Connor McDavid went first. Jack Eichel is a Boston kid. We think, I don't know this, I asked Boston, they told me to mind my own business. We think they might have been trying to get 3 picks in a row to try and get to 2. But that's why I think they wanted our picks.
Okay, then. Who else has a question? Just over here, then.
Yeah, you don't need a mic. Go ahead.
Yeah, they're recording it.
Cody, you're going to... That one I got. Okay. When I was taking questions from the kids today, the accent stumped me a couple of times. So, but I think I got it. Cody Franson. Right shot defenseman, 6'4". Has he signed yet? I don't think so. Yeah, he's not coming to us. I had him in Vancouver. He's a great kid. He's from Sikkimoose, B.C., British Columbia. He's from the same, he's from a really good family. He's a quality person. But he's had 2 tough years from my perspective. And right now we're going with the D that we have. So I hope he gets something. He is a good kid.
Okay, then I will take one more. Anyone else who has a question before we move on to our raffle tonight?
Sir. Thank you.
I
I did too, right up till the firing part. Well, Pavel Bure was, I should have mentioned Pavel when someone asked me the best, did you ask me the best player? They should have mentioned Pavel Bure. I was there when we drafted Pavel Bure. He's the most exciting player I ever had. He's explosive, 50-plus goals, but he sold tickets. There are a lot of great players in pro sports. There are a lot of great players in the NFL that never sell a ticket. There are a lot of great players in the NHL that never sell a ticket. Pavel Bure sold tickets. Like, people bought tickets just to watch him. And he was a really impressive physical specimen. Now, when I got to Vancouver in 98, he had already told the Canucks he would not play for them again. And I said, Pavel, I was there. I drove him into Canada. When we first drafted Pavel, we had to go through a lawsuit with the Red Army team to get him free to play. And so I was in Detroit, meeting with lawyers all day in court and then after court at the lawyers' offices and then trying to sign Pavel at night. Finally, we got him out on Thursday. And so he flew to Spokane, and then the next day I flew to Seattle, met him there, and I drove him to the rink in Vancouver. So I said, Pavel, I drove you into this country. The least you can do is play for me. I'll trade you. Give me till Christmas, but play. And he said no. And there's real hard feelings about something that happened in ownership. He's never confess what it was. I think what it was there was a rumor that was floated that in 94 in the finals, he refused to play unless they gave him a contract extension. That's a pretty lousy thing for a player to do to his teammates. And I asked Pat Quinn about it, and Pat said it never happened. So I think the fact that no one from the team came out and defended him, he'd had enough at that point. So I said to him, well, look, you can't trade star players until there's a certain level of desperation from a team. It'll be Christmas time. I said, you're sitting out now till Christmas. I'm not going to do it to punish you, but I can promise you I won't be able to make the deal I need to make for you till after Christmas. And I wasn't. I traded him to Florida. Got Eddie Jovanovski, Mike Brown, a first. I don't know what else came in that. It was a big deal. But he went on and had 250-goal seasons there, and we were really happy with what we got back. Eddie Jovanovski was an important player for us. But that's why I traded him, not because, people have said to me since then, well, you don't like Russians or what? I'm like, I like good players. I don't care where they're from. The day will come, as hockey grows in this country, the day will come when an Irish-born and developed player, I know that Irish-born players have played in the NHL, including Owen Nolan, but the day will come when an Irish-born and developed player plays in our league, no question.
Can I ask you one about your relationship with the press?
Sure. Well, I was trying to get them to identify with me. Here's the problem. The problem is, if you look at Vancouver, if you look at all the guys I dealt with there, I had a great relationship with all of them except Tony Gallagher. And Tony Gallagher, I don't think this has a good relationship with anybody. I'm not sure there's a person that knows him that likes hanging around him. So, it goes back to, all right, how much of our job are we supposed to just take this abuse, and how much do we fight back? And my view is, I'm fighting back. You write something, and most of the fights I got in with the media, and will again, I'm not retired, and will again, centered on nothing that was written about me. I don't read the papers. Like, the rule number one, if you want to work in our business, you don't read any of that. You do not read the paper. First off, you're not going to learn anything about hockey in a newspaper, not if you're a GM. And if you can learn something in a newspaper, you ought to be fired. So you're not going to learn anything. So all you're going to do is get annoyed. And so I don't read. When our team's playing well, you might look at it. But in general, you just, like my desk in Toronto, they put the clips outside every day, right? Some PR intern comes by with all the newspaper clippings from the day. Every newspaper that has NHL articles in it is in the clips. So if there's a lot of games, the clips might be 120 pages. And if it's a slow night, it might be 40 pages. And they pile up. And they pile up and they pile up. They get about 2 feet high, and I shove them off the desk into a garbage can. And so I remember doing an interview with Damian Cox, who's a Toronto media, good guy. And he said, you know, that garbage about you not reading the media, I don't believe it. I said, well, come out here, I'll show you. And there's a 2-foot pile, and I said, watch. Everything you wrote in the last 2 weeks is in here, right in the trash. So rule number one is you don't read it. Rule number two is the average person, I mean, I assume honesty and good intentions from people. Like, it's pretty hard to live your life if you don't assume that. I assume the average person would like to do their job well and honestly and competently. And we're lucky that in hockey, most of the people that cover teams are honest, competent people that want to get it right and are interested in promoting the sport. The problem is the ones that don't do it that way, you have to either respond in a real negative way to them or they get credence and credibility in the media. I mean, I'll give you an example. I was in Kandahar on July 1st, Kandahar, Afghanistan. This is the real deal, visiting Canadian soldiers. When you leave the barracks, you got to wear a full anti-personnel vest and helmet. Second trip I was there, we went off the base to visit a forward operating base, flew tactically the whole time. You're at risk there. You have to sign a waiver, whole thing. Now, is it even close to being a soldier? No, but you're at risk. You're there visiting the Canadian soldiers who are in a war zone. And I got hammered by Steve Simmons in the paper for not being there to sign free agents on July 1st. I'm doing Canada Day in Kandahar, and I'm getting slammed for not being there. I was like, I couldn't believe it. I had a live phone link from the major's office on the base. My cell phone worked. My laptop was hooked up. We were plugged in just like everybody else. And so that's what you contend with. When you do something that risky and that selfless, and you get dinged for it, so yeah, my fights with the media have been legendary, and I predict they will continue.
Well, it's on behalf of the Centreline Belfast Giants, the Irish Ice Hockey Association, and the Heroes, we'd like to thank you for taking time out of your holiday, your family holiday, for coming along to host this tonight here at W5.
My pleasure, and I meant what I said. The day will come. I've watched, in the 25 years I've been doing this, I've watched the evolution of hockey in Europe, how Switzerland has gone from a country with no players in the league to now 20-plus, how Germany has developed. The same thing's going to happen here. We just need to build some rinks. The same thing will happen here. If there was ever a sport that was designed with the Irish people in mind, it's hockey. So it's my great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Burke.